Welcome to Street Knowledge with Chris Graham.
It's Tuesday. We'll talk news today here on the podcast. I'm Chris Graham, joined by Crystal Graham, and we have a lot of local, regional, and state news and politics with Election Day being a week away from today. We'll probably talk some election. We'll talk some COVID numbers. Crystal, a lot on the agenda with the news business these days.
Yes, Chris, I thought we would start maybe. We went to an event on the Charlottesville downtown mall on Sunday where Democrat gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe was flanked by Stacey Abram and also Dave Matthews, who played a few acoustic tunes there and went relatively well attended, I would say, probably over 1,000 people for sure there. I don't know if you saw any crowd estimates as to how many people were there thrown together in a very short period of time, which usually happens as you get closer to the election. A couple, you know, events are thrown together last minute just to kind of do that last minute dash throughout the state. I think McAuliffe was actually going to be in Harrisonburg today or may have already been in Harrisonburg earlier today for the get out the vote kind of rallies that are being held statewide. I know former President Barack Obama joined him on the trail in some of the bigger cities throughout Virginia last week, and I think is on the trail this week as well. But Chris, you know, it brings up kind of a bigger issue, and you wrote about this on Augusta Free Press, which is this enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats. I was talking with a Republican friend last week, and her and I were just chatting about the election in general and that kind of thing. And, you know, she said she feels like the Republicans are very energized, where on the flip side, I'm kind of seeing that Democrats maybe aren't quite as enthusiastic. Just a lot of them kind of feel like, okay, McAuliffe has been, you know, governor before, you know, and maybe just for whatever reason aren't as energized with him at the top of the ticket this go round. I do think with what's happening in Texas and other states that eventually, you know, the Democrats are going to say the alternative is worse and they're going to turn out to vote. But what are your thoughts on that? And what are you seeing as far as trends and polls and that kind of thing as we lead up to Election Day on Tuesday?
Well, anecdotally, Sunday at the downtown mall at the Ting Pavilion, Terry McAuliffe got the third most cheers of the three people you mentioned. Stacey Abrams and Dave Matthews were 1 and 1A. I'm not sure. Abrams may be a little bit more even than Dave, the hometown hero, though Dave live in person, it was just amazing. Hadn't heard him for quite a while. Been a couple of years at least since we heard him in concert. So that was great. But Stacey Abrams energized the crowd, and Terry McAuliffe was smart to book those two to be there with him. And we've been to events there. It was nowhere near the turnout that Snoop Dogg had a few years ago when we were there at the downtown mall, the pavilion there. So, but you know, yeah, there was a good turnout. It was more than I thought there might be on a Sunday with short notice. That's anecdotal, though. I did a piece today, as you mentioned, Crystal, looking at early voting numbers. You can go to the VPAP, Virginia Public Access Project website, and get their yesterday's numbers through the end of yesterday. Anyway, the number of early votes cast in Virginia, 724,965. And it's about five times more than we had at this point in the 2017 gubernatorial cycle. But it's also a lot less than we had in last year's presidential cycle when early voting really took off. We had about 2.7 million votes, early votes, last year in 2020 in Virginia alone, about almost 60% of the 4.5 million votes cast in Virginia overall in the presidential election. And so to be a fourth of the way there suggests that, hey, that's not good. Now, turnout in presidentials last year it was 75% of the overall registered voter base. Gubernatorial elections get a lot less. The last three cycles, we've had around 40 to 45% of overall voter turnout. So it's a lot less. It's about half, we'll say, right? But we only have about a fourth of the early votes that we had last year. And we've got 5 days to go early voting. You can vote all the way to Saturday early. You can early vote in person. You can mail in your votes through next Tuesday, as long as it's postmarked next Tuesday. I wouldn't count on those being counted the way the USPS is working right now, but you can still do that. But we're going to get nowhere near last year's numbers in that sense. And why that matters to Democrats, this is, you know, our podcast, we lean obviously Democratic very much so. The reason this matters to Democrats is early votes last year really, really seriously trended towards the Democratic candidates. So I use two examples in my story. There's 133 localities in Virginia, but I use the most Democratic county, Fairfax County, in one of the most, if not the most, Republican counties, which is our Augusta County. In deep blue Fairfax County, Biden actually outperformed his overall vote total in Fairfax by 7% just among the early votes. He had 76.9% of the absentee votes and 7% or 69.9% of the vote overall. So 7% ahead with the early votes. That means Democrats were voting more early. Even in Augusta County, where Biden only got 25.6% of the overall votes, he got 37.4% of the early votes, almost 12% more. So Democrats tend to vote earlier, right? With those new, with this, these new laws and the new trends that we have in place, we tend to vote earlier. So the fact that we're only about a fourth of to where we were last year in terms of the number of early votes suggests that Democrats just aren't enthusiastic. And that's not going to be good news for Democrats if that trend continues. And we have 5 days to correct for it, but it's not a good trend for Democrats.
Chris, is there any chance that it also has something to do with COVID? Last year, around this time, COVID was very rampant. People were locked down. And so maybe that was the reason that more people turned out to early vote. And maybe now that a lot of people are vaccinated and that kind of thing, people are a little more comfortable going to vote on election day.
I don't know if we'll know the answer to that until after this election, when we get full numbers of early votes through the state and in various localities, and then see how the results are. You know, if Democrats go out on election day next week and vote in similar percentages as last year, or close to similar percentages as last year, then I would say that we have our answer, that the answer would be, yes, it was a more COVID thing. If Republicans win, if Glenn Youngkin wins and Republicans win the state races across the down the ticket and maybe take back control of the House of Delegates, I don't think we'll have a definitive answer, but we can maybe say, well, the early voting trends of 2020 didn't carry to 2021 and Democrats just weren't as enthused. So I don't know that we know the answer to that yet, but if I were a consultant or a higher up in a Democratic campaign, the McAuliffe campaign or running the state Democratic Party, I would be very worried and at seeing these early voting numbers. And they, of course, I'm telling you about them now. I'm sure they've been trending, tracking them every day since early voting started back in September.
Two other things related to Election Day. You know, Biden won Virginia pretty strongly, right? 10 or 11 points. Yeah. So, you know, I'm curious with your prognosticator hat on, so to speak, though, what you think is going to happen in this Youngkin-McAuliffe race. Like, I imagine it's going to be much closer.
Well, there's the early voting trends that I've noticed and written about and talked about here extensively in the last couple of minutes. And go to the website and get the details. There's a lot of numbers in there. I kind of dazzle you with numbers with that story. Another thing that makes you think, McAuliffe back in 2013, and I mentioned this in the early voting story, he rather severely underperformed his polls. The Real Clear Politics average of polls in 2013, the final one before the election, had McAuliffe winning by a pretty comfortable 6-point margin. People remember he won by 2 points on election night over Ken Cuccinelli. And then Mark Herring, his first election, actually had I think there was a recount with his election against Mark Obenchain for attorney general. And so Democrats that cycle actually looked pretty good. And then in the polls, they looked really good in the polls. And then things on election night went haywire. And actually in 2014, Mark Warner had a bigger lead in the polls. He was ahead in some of the polls just before the election, as much as 10 points, won by less than a percentage point. So there've been a couple of recent cycles. I'm calling 2013 and 2014 recent cycles in Virginia where Democrats have underperformed their polls. I say that to then say this right now, that all the polls have it basically a dead heat. The ones who assign undecided voters, you know, that kind of pry on the undecided voters and say, okay, you're undecided right now, but if the election were today, who would you vote for? Those have the election 49-49 or 48-48. VCU gets some criticism. The Douglas Wilder School of Government and Policy at VCU gets some criticism from political observers because they don't pry. They want to know who's hardcore McAuliffe in this case, hardcore Youngkin, and then they leave the undecideds to be undecided because if you're undecided, you're undecided. You got a week to decide. And they've got it 41-38 in favor of McAuliffe, but still very, you know, that's obviously very close, especially with what would that be, 21% or roughly 21% undecided. And so that tells you that, you know, matter which way you go, if you pin down the undecideds, it's a close race. If you don't pin them down, there's a lot of voters who can either make up their minds or change their minds between now and election day. This race is up for grabs.
Historically, I remember that it used to be that when the Democrats were in charge in Washington, you know, at the presidential level, that in Virginia, it tended to go the other direction. You know, it was kind of like back and forth. I don't know if that, I think I read that somewhere. I think that there might be some truth to that. Obviously, Northern Virginia numbers have been very powerful in recent years, and Virginia has gone from a red state to a purple state, she's probably now a leaning blue state. But what are your thoughts on that historically, and, you know, and what that could mean for the race?
I think I looked this up once, and I haven't done it for a while, so because I didn't write it down. But I think it goes all the way back to the early 70s that Virginia, because we're one of the few states that has off year elections like this, odd numbered year elections like this. And I think there's two others. I want to say it's New Jersey and Kentucky, but I'm not going to, don't hold me to that, that have odd numbered year elections after a presidential election. And Virginia being the, you know, the biggest, most populous state of those three, and the one that leans, because Kentucky right now is Democratic governor, but they tend to be Republican. New Jersey's had Republican governors, but they tend to be very Democratic. Virginia is a state that has, can go either way and has for quite a while. So we're the one that gets looked at the next year. And a lot of what gets attributed to why, because it's not just Democrats in the White House and then Republicans winning at the state level. Even in the 2000s, when George W. Bush won in 2000 and 2004, Mark Warner won in 2001 in Virginia, Tim Kaine won in 2005 in Virginia. That streak got broken in 2013 when Terry McAuliffe, a year after Barack Obama got reelected, Terry McAuliffe won the Virginia governor's race. In 2017, Ralph Northam won a year after Donald Trump won. But I don't know that that's so much a repudiation of the Republican in D.C. as it was just a continuation of a trend in Virginia. Since, I mean, really dating back in 2009, there was that weird blip, now that we look at it, where McDonald in Virginia won the governor's race a year after Barack Obama. But even dating back to that upset win for Jim Webb in 2006 over George Allen, who was thinking about running for president in 2008, Virginia started moving blue at that point. Even Mark Warner, Tim Kaine, I mentioned 2001, 2005. Talking a lot there, I'm getting to that trend that had been noticed, Crystal, that you mentioned there, the year after, Virginia tends to maybe has at least had a history of going the other direction, Republican, Democrat, Democrat, Republican, has always been looked at as, okay, you know, the first year of a presidency tends to be tough. And we're seeing that with Joe Biden. You know, you inherit the problems of your predecessor. And I don't know that any president other than a wartime or post-war president has inherited a more delicate situation than what Joe Biden inherited from Donald Trump. We've had 700,000 total deaths in the coronavirus, 300,000 this year. The rollout of the vaccines, trying to prevent more. Still trying to wrap up wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Joe Biden makes a decision to pull troops out of Afghanistan. That's criticized, even though Donald Trump had wanted to do so for 4 years and did not at the end do that. The economy yo-yoing like it is, gas prices being what they are. We're going to talk about that in a moment. And so Biden inherits a tough situation. Most presidents inherit a tough situation. And so what happens is then you've only got a few months of looking at, in this case, Joe Biden. And you say, I mean, look at it. Terry McAuliffe's not mentioning Joe Biden's name on the campaign trail. And Republicans aren't really mentioning Donald Trump's name on the campaign trail. It's pretty much Republicans are running against Biden and Democrats are trying to figure out how to not run with Biden. And they're doing that by running with Stacey Abrams and with Barack Obama. And the enthusiasm gap is there as a result.
All right. So you bring up Trump a few times during this discussion. And so there's a lot being said about this Virginia election and about which direction it goes could really determine if Trump throws his hat in the ring again in 2024, running for president again. How do you feel about that? Are the stakes that high?
Donald Trump's running for president in 2024 as long as he's alive in 2024, no matter what happens. I don't think
alive and not in jail, some would say, right?
But yeah, well,
not that I anticipate that will happen, but just say
I don't anticipate either happening. But he is getting older, And he's not all that healthy all the time. He doesn't certainly eat healthy. He doesn't look healthy. But, I mean, let's just assume 2024 comes. Donald Trump is still the whatever robust level of Donald Trump that he is now. I don't think he cares if Republicans lose every single election between now and 2024. He's running. But definitely this would give him a tailwind, you know, thinking in terms of track, running on a track. The wind is at his back here. If Virginia, for example, could be a first step. I mean, there's a lot that happens between now and 2024. There's midterms next year. What this really is, Virginia, is a headwind or tailwind for both parties going into the 2022 midterms. And, you know, Joe Biden, this in one sense, this is the first referendum on the Joe Biden presidency, which is not good for Democrats in Virginia, particularly because Joe Biden's approval numbers are the second lowest in modern polling history for any first year president. The predecessor being Donald Trump, he was the lowest. And Trump was historically low throughout his presidency in terms of approval ratings. But Joe Biden is in Trump territory as far as that goes. That is not a good place to be.
Okay, Chris, so I'm going to shift gears just a little bit, but I'm going to stick with politics. And I want to talk about the 20th House District race between John Evoli, of course, the former Stanton mayor. He's the incumbent, and he is facing off against a relatively political newcomer, Randall Wolf. As the House District is currently drawn, you might say, hey, Democrats have a chance of winning that House race. But you did basically a breakdown of the jurisdiction, so to speak, and just thought I'd let you break that down a little bit for us as well.
Yeah, you know, I mean, House districts in Virginia, there's 8.35 million residents in Virginia. There's 100 House districts. What that tells you is there should be roughly 84,000, 83,500 people living per House district. And so when you look at the 20th House district, it's got two cities in it. Cities in Virginia, cities nationwide tend to be Democratic. The 20th has Stanton and Waynesboro. The weird thing here is that Waynesboro is not a Democratic-leaning city. Waynesboro is also a city that doesn't have a college in it. Most colleges, in fact, all colleges within 100 miles of us, excuse me, all cities within 100 miles of us, cities, independent cities, have at least one college. Some have two. And so colleges tend to make your city more Democratic, and Waynesboro lacks a college. Waynesboro, as a result, does lean a little, at least, Republican. But on paper, you'd say, hey, there's a chance there. We got two cities. Nelson County tends to lean blue, but the four precincts, we get half of Nelson County in the 20th district. The four precincts actually lean a little Democratic, but not as much as it needs to. If you look at the Augusta County portion of the district, Augusta County's portion of the 20th district is about a third of the district. And that I looked at each of those individual precincts in 2016 and 2017. Did not do 2020. I'll explain here quickly why. 2020, there were so many early votes, as we discussed earlier, being cast. Those all got counted in the absentee precinct. Really 2020, for analysis purposes, from a district by district, precinct by precinct level, rendered useless. We can't really do a precinct by precinct analysis from 2020 because of that. And we'll have to figure out a way in the future to I've even seen some columns on this topic. Let's figure out a way in the future to be able to go back to doing our district by district analysis, precinct by precinct analysis that way. But when you look back at 2016 and 2017, the Augusta County portions of the district went 73% for Trump in 2016, 74% for Ed Gillespie, who ran for governor in 2017 against Ralph Northam. Also in 2017, though, Gillespie in 2017 got 74%. Dickie Bell, in what turned out to be his last run as the 20th district Republican nominee, only got 54.5%. And so that made you think, hey, this district's in play. 2019, someone we know very well, Jennifer Lewis, here from Waynesboro, ran in the 20th. And actually, John Evoli, the Stanton mayor you mentioned, who is now the incumbent, won that election with a somewhat surprising 58.5%. I say somewhat surprising. It was a district that, again, 2 years prior had gone 54.5% for the Republican. And then this was an open seat. These were two new candidates. There was no power of incumbency that played a role in 2019. So Evoli outran Dickie Bell, who had, I think that was his fifth run in the 20th district. So now it's Evoli and Randall Wolf, who is a newcomer, as you mentioned, a very much a newcomer. And Evoli is the incumbent now in the district. And it's a district that, you know, when you look at the numbers, it does seem to, I mean, when you look at the numbers overall in the 20th, the 2016-2017 cycles went about 57% Republican. It went 58.5% Republican in 2019. And so there's a chance there if you're Randall Wolf, but Randall Wolf has not raised a lot of money. His campaign receipts right now show $30,000. If I've been asking the past, Crystal, when I take my journalism hat off and put a political consultant hat on, I've actually consulted with a couple of people who were considering running for House delegate seats locally, and including two who, I want to say a couple, there were two who wanted to run for the 20th district seat years ago. I told them, be prepared to raise, if you can't raise $200,000, you're not going to win. Randall Wolf has raised $30,000. We're a week out from the election. He's not going to raise $200,000. He's not going to get $170,000 in the last week. I have not, Crystal, you and I watch a lot of TV. We watch a lot of stuff on YouTube TV, on YouTube, on the cable. I've yet to see a single Randall Wolf commercial. Now, I've not seen a John Avoli commercial, but he's the incumbent. He doesn't need to. It's a district that's close to 60% Republican. So the quieter it goes, the better it is for John Avoli. And it's been really quiet in the 20th district. So I think what that kind of tells me is this seat, which I think can be won by a Democrat, is not going to go Democrat this cycle.
Okay, Chris, let's shift gears just a little bit. And people are talking about gas prices nonstop. And of course, they're higher than I can remember them being probably in my lifetime right now. There's a lot of blame being given to Biden on that. And I know that you can probably break down what actually determines gas prices. But as you wrote a story today, that Virginia gas prices have risen 6.6 cents per gallon in the past week. I was hoping maybe you could do an update on that as far as, you know, an analysis of that, what we might be looking at down the line, and maybe some historical trends as well.
Well, that 6.6 cents in the last week, 27.4 cents in the last month, and $1.19 a gallon higher than a year ago at this time. So yeah, the prices have been really going up just, you know, relatively recently, pretty sharply. It has nothing to do with Biden, just like high or low gas prices had nothing to do with Trump or Obama or George W. Bush or any president. Gas prices are dependent upon a lot of things, but production, it's anybody who's taken an economics class, high school or college, it's supply and demand. And right now you have OPEC, which is largely Middle Eastern countries. There are some South American countries and even Canada. I think Canada is a major oil supplier. OPEC has decided, I don't think Canada's in OPEC now that I say that, don't write me about that, but Canada is a major oil supplier. In fact, we get, I think, a good percentage of our oil from Canada, which makes sense, they're close by. But when you look at the world markets, OPEC controls so much of the world market that they can, you know, their decisions on production can influence prices up or down. And right now, OPEC is influencing prices up. And oil right now is $83 a barrel. And gas prices had not reflected for months what oil prices were. And so usually this time of year, there's actually a slowdown in prices. Prices tend to go down a little bit because the summer travel season's over. You know, we're not going to the beach anymore. People tend to hunker down. School's back in session. And so people aren't traveling as much on vacations and that kind of thing, business trips, you know, whatever the case may be. And so prices tend to go down a little bit this time of year, but because of the need to catch up to the jump in oil prices that started a month ago, prices have been going up pretty precipitously. The story we wrote, we quoted Patrick DeHaan, who's the head of petroleum analysis for Gas Buddy. We use Gas Buddy numbers quite a bit. In fact, we use them every Monday on our site. He projects that in the coming weeks, prices will probably flatten and maybe even start going back down a bit. That's one of those things, just kind of, it's not going to help you out today. It's not going to help you out this week necessarily, but they will go back down, and that won't be because of Joe Biden either. They didn't go up because of Joe Biden. They won't go down because of Joe Biden.
All right, Chris, shifting gears. We've been talking about COVID numbers a lot on our podcast, on our news podcast, and the situation at Augusta Health seems to be improving. Can you give us an update on that?
Yeah. When we were talking back in mid-September, there was definitely a COVID surge locally. I had been tracking the numbers at Augusta Health for the past year, and the height last year that I can recall, just, you know, kind of recalling in my head, in terms of inpatient COVID census at Augusta Health was in the mid-30s. There in mid-September, we had one week where the average was 63. We're back down lower. This week, as of yesterday, at least, Augusta Health reported that the inpatient census was 27. So still lower than the peak of last year, much lower than the peak of a month ago. And over the 24 hours preceding 9 a.m. yesterday, just 9 new positive COVID cases diagnosed through Augusta Health testing sites. I mean, we had days a month ago where there were over 100 per day being diagnosed just by Augusta Health. So from 100 down to 9, over 100 down to 9. Those are important numbers to note. Another important thing to note, we talked about this, well, we wrote about this last week. Augusta Health is in the process of resuming elective services, which is important. And also the hospital for the past, I'd say 6 weeks, maybe a little bit longer, had been operating 2 ICUs, one ICU specific to COVID patients, another just for all other patients. Now the hospital is back to just one ICU. So the situation is a lot better. Unfortunately, the vaccination numbers haven't improved very much. And so right now it seems like we've gotten to the Delta variant, but right now also we're getting, we can feel the chill in the air coming. Yesterday it was 75 degrees, today a lot cooler. When you look at the weather forecast, it's going to be a lot cooler the next 10 days. We are finally getting into not just fall, but like mid-fall to late fall type weather. And that means more people are going to be inside. I mean, we're transitioning from football season, if you're a sports fan, to basketball season, being outside to being inside. We're not far from Thanksgiving where families will get together, inside again. This is the time of year that normally you see colds increase, flus increase. We both got flu shots yesterday, Crystal. We've already both been fully vaccinated for COVID. But this is the time of year that colds and flus naturally, I mean, for as long as any of us remember have been on the increase. We have to hope that because even we're not close right yet to our where we need to be from a COVID vaccination standpoint. Here in Augusta County, Crystal, I did a story on this last week. I estimated that we need 26,000 more people in Augusta County to get to 75% fully vaccinated. There's 123,000 residents in Augusta County, Stanton, and Waynesboro. So when I say that number, 26,000, that's more than either of the population of Stanton or Waynesboro. We need basically the equivalent of the population of one of the two cities to still get vaccinated, to get to 75% and consider ourselves at quote unquote herd immunity. In Virginia, we need 1.1 million more people to get vaccinated, to get to 75% of our state being fully vaccinated. These are still big numbers and there's no reason for this. There's plenty of vaccines out there. People are just choosing not to get them.
Well, and of course, in coming weeks, children ages 5 to 11 should be able to get the vaccinations. So that's just a matter of time. And then we're also looking at now a ton of people getting these booster shots, right? The recommendation is now that, especially if you're 65 plus, or if you're in one of those areas where you work with older people or younger people, or you're in front of the public a lot, there are recommendations that you get a booster shot. And right now it looks like you can mix and match them, right? So if you've got Johnson & Johnson, you can still get the Pfizer booster if you want, or there's really, no delays on that. And from what I understand, the Moderna booster is going to be available later this week as well. So a lot of people are starting to get boosted, but that doesn't increase our overall numbers that you're talking about there. It just means that the people who have already gotten vaccinated are choosing to get more protection against the variant and things of that nature. So
you'll have some people with 3 shots and some people with no shots. And that's not, that's not a situation that's going to prevent community spread, unfortunately.
Right.
All the people who get the booster shots. Now, again, like you mentioned, Crystal, the people over 65, that the FDA, outside experts advising the FDA voted unanimously for people over 65. The votes for other classes of people or subgroups or populations of people were more divided. There's controversy about that because, we're not the only country in the world with COVID. I know a lot of folks politically want to make that point on both sides. Hey, we're the only people that are dealing with this. We need this disease, this virus, to be quelled worldwide. And we need third world countries that maybe can't afford to have vaccines. We need to get the vaccines in their arms too. That's part of the controversy is do we, because at this stage, booster shots don't, it's really just a matter of if you've already been fully vaccinated, yes, you can still get COVID, but the boosters will prevent you from getting even a mild case of COVID. You'll be asymptomatic and carry it perhaps if you do have a breakthrough case, but it'll be mild. We're basically going to put more shots in some people's arms to lessen the severity of their COVID when there are still millions of Americans. There are 1.1 million Virginians, 26,000 people just here in Waynesboro, Stanton, Augusta County that need to get this vaccine. And get one shot in their arms, and then the second shot, if it's not the Johnson & Johnson, much less a third. Folks out there, you know, I'm sure a lot of folks listening are people who've already gotten vaccinated. You're thinking about your booster. Before you get your booster, I would encourage, if you know one person that hasn't gotten any shots, put your efforts towards that. That's going to help stop the spread of this a lot better than you getting a third shot. I'm not telling you not to get the third shot, but what I'm telling you is we're going to still be under the throes of COVID as long as we have people who are resistant to the vaccines. And we don't get to 75%, we don't get to 80%, we don't get to even higher numbers of people who are vaccinated. That's what we need to put our focus on.
All right. I know we're running a little long, but I have to talk about something that always makes my blood pressure rise. And it's the story regarding Waynesboro City Council and a proposed animal ordinance. You all may recall us talking about this a lot in August when City Council, actually the city manager, first presented an ordinance to City Council to review that had to do with dogs and cats and chickens and roosters and pigs. And eventually they ended up saying, okay, we're not going to put restrictions on dogs and cats, right? But we're going to look more at the chickens and the pigs and the roosters and that kind of thing. And we're going to come back to you later. Yeah, right. And we're going to come back to you later and we're going to, come back to you with another proposal. And so, you know, we thought that the city council was doing the right thing, but, I'm just going to be honest about how I feel about this. I got upset because about midweek last week, about Wednesday, I started hearing rumblings that City Council was going to be presenting the next draft of this ordinance. And I know that they said dogs and cats were off the table, but it doesn't mean that I'm not emotionally invested at this point. I've met a lot of people who have roosters and chickens and pigs and, you know, and that no one's ever made a complaint about in the city, right? So I'm telling them, you know, hey, we're still following this story. We're still going to continue to stay on this. And then we weren't real sure. We were waiting for the agenda to be posted, which wasn't posted till sometime on Friday, which is already kind of late considering the meeting was Monday. The meeting was scheduled to be moved to Waynesboro High School. So, you know, not at its normal place at City Hall. And we get the agenda and it does in fact show that they're going to be discussing it. Again, that Mike Hamp was coming back with another proposal. It did not get posted on the city's website, the actual agenda packet, until 3:15 on Friday afternoon. And here was my deal. I sent a note to City Council. I sent it to Mike Hamp and I sent it to Julia Bortle, who's the clerk of Waynesboro City Council. And I said, I don't even care what's in this at this point. What I care about is the fact that you're not giving people time to review this before presenting it. Like, I thought that council would have learned its lesson, right? Because last time the city manager presented something on a Thursday. And I remember that many of the city council members said, hey, we just looked at this the same time you did. And yeah, you're right. We have questions about this too. In this case, again, instead of like, you know, what I thought would happen this time is that maybe there'd be another draft. And instead of the city manager presenting it in a public forum to city council, maybe they just say, okay, here's kind of what we're looking at. And they bring in some organizations, you know, that deal with animals and that kind of thing to review it. But it seems to me what they were trying to do was release this as late as possible on a Friday before a Monday meeting and not give people the opportunity to speak. The thing that infuriated me was that basically it was like on the agenda that the city council could choose to introduce it at the meeting on Monday night after the city manager presented it, right? Giving no opportunity, again, hardly, for people to speak out against it. While there wouldn't have been a vote on Monday night, it would have been introduced and then a vote would likely have come at the first November meeting, November 8th or something like that, right? So to me, it was just like, what is the rush on this? Like, why not have, there were several, last night, there were several public hearings on other matters scheduled. So what's the rush? And why not have a public hearing on this and let people speak out? I've gotten to know a Waynesboro resident on Brunswick Avenue, Leah Cave, I believe. And, you know, one of the things is she does have chickens and roosters and pigs. She has two house pigs, I think. She said she's emailed every member of city council and none of them have responded to her. She needs to know whether she needs to put her house on the market, right? Because if they're not going to allow pigs, then she's going to move. These things are crazy. And so I'll get back to the point. Okay, so rant over. But the city council ended up pulling it from the agenda, right? They decided, maybe it's because several people emailed like me, like, what is the rush on this? But apparently Bobby Henderson was quoted by WHSB. Yeah. I'm sorry?
The mayor.
Right. The mayor, Bobby Henderson, was quoted by WHSB saying, look, we still have questions about this and let's work on it in some work sessions first and then we'll present it later. And so it sounds like later is going to be January is when they're going to be looking at this again and bringing this back before the council and before the public to review again. My hope is that when they present it, that they actually have a public hearing and plenty of time for public input before they would introduce it and have a vote on it, right? Like a lot of people, these animals, whether they're pigs or chickens or roosters, whatever they are, they're their pets, right? And I'm a dog lover, but I can understand love of pets. So just give everybody time to speak and then figure out what's best for the community. And then the other part of my rant is when you're talking about a grandfather clause, you can't say you have 1 to 3 years when a pig's life might be 18 years, right? A grandfather clause should be just that, should be the lifetime of the animal. And then if we're looking at the long-term perspective for Waynesboro, and they don't want roosters and they don't want pigs, and lots of cities have regulations of that nature, just be fair to the people who weren't doing anything wrong outside of the law up until now, right? So, that's my two cents on it, Chris. I know that's kind of not the news side of it. It's more the rant side of it. The news side of it is, of course, that there was a decision to delay this ordinance, probably not going to come back up until at least January. Anything you want to add to that? Because I know I went on.
No. What I would suggest is just without having the emotion to it, it's very similar thrust though from me, is I would say city council, before this is introduced as an ordinance, let's do something that should have been done before this was introduced back in August, which is, all right, we have a working document from the city staff. Let's present it to city council, not have any language on the agenda saying this could be introduced by city council as a proposed ordinance. Let's just propose this to city council. Let's review it and then have the public hearing, have public input. And before anything is introduced, you have the public input first. This seems like it's not very hard to figure out. This is how you should do everything really when you're talking about city government, but especially something like this. And maybe this could set a precedent for city council in Waynesboro. I mean, it should be the precedent we have really across our country and how government is done. Our staff, we pay these people good money to do the work that they do on our behalf to come up with ideas for laws, how we can do things better, how we can be as fair as possible to everybody concerned. Because, you know, for every person who is a person who is good with their pets, there may be a few who aren't, and their neighbors deserve protections too. So, okay, let's be fair to everybody. But being fair doesn't mean, I mean, we Crystal, we'll bring it up again if we have to. We did a Freedom of Information Act request. We know that literally three people were pushing this on city council for the last 3 years, and not three members of city council, three private residents were pushing this for the last 3 years. We will name them if we have to. We'll go into great detail about who they are and what their motivations are and who's listening to them and who's kowtowing to them. And at the expense of listening to everyone. I don't care that those three people should be heard. And so should everyone else who wants to weigh in on this before something's even introduced by city council as a proposed ordinance. So that's my take on this. Fair to everyone, not just fair to people I agree with, fair to people, that whoever else agrees with, fair to everybody involved.
Yeah, absolutely agree, Chris. And just, you know, I know city council is, are they paid anything? I know they get some
not a lot, and certainly not anything. It's like 10 or 11,000. I'd have to look it up, but it's certainly not. It's a full time job, and you get paid very limited part time wages. So no.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that, you know, when you take on the responsibility of this, I understand that this issue and other issues, you may be bombarded with emails and things of that nature. But I do think that it's not really right not to respond to someone who takes time to write you an email. Someone like Leah Cave, who says she emailed each individual member of council and didn't get a single reply. I mean, when we were in the height of this and when cats and dogs were still on the table, I know I at least got a almost like an autoresponder, but that wasn't what it was. But, you know, a copy and paste kind of thing. Here's what I'm sending to everyone who sends me an email on this issue, you know, from some of the city council members. I did hear back from a few of them, you know, but I just don't think you should go radio silent. I think it's a job where you have to respond. You have to initiate conversation. I mean, she says, look, come out to my farm. Before you make a decision on this, you know, come out here and see my property. You know what I mean?
To be fair, they did respond by taking it off the agenda. So
correct. You're right. In that respect, they did.
I think more than a response, if I were in the situation that some of those folks were in, I would just want them to delay consideration until everyone can be heard. But that said, let's not just delay it until January and then do the same thing on a Friday before a Monday meeting, throw something up on the website and here you go. You got 2 days to figure this out.
Because even if there was some other reason that it was delayed, it looks bad, right? It looks bad when you put something up at 3:30 on a Friday before a Monday meeting. And I know I said in my email to them, and I don't know what the regulations are, but shouldn't there be some kind of like, you know, regulation that says you have to have at least 2 business days to review things before, you know, before they go before a city council or something like that. If there's not a regulation like that in place, there should be, right? Because the public deserves opportunity to look things over. And you can say, oh, well, they had the weekend. But when you look at actual business days, yeah, it was just very limited. It just seemed sneaky to me. And maybe it wasn't intended to be, but it felt that way. And
I can tell you, if I ran for city council, it's been well known. Crystal unfortunately knows it really well. I ran for city council in 2008. If I were sitting on that city council right now, I would be reminding the staff who works for who. The city council doesn't work for the city manager. The city council doesn't work for the staff. The city manager and the staff work for city council. This is twice now on this very simple issue. Now we have to wonder how many other issues are this way, where staff got ahead, way ahead of where city council wanted to be, was comfortable being on this relatively simple issue. And it had to be pulled back off because the people spoke and then the city councilor said, nope, can't do that. Let's go back and revisit this. I think one time's a mistake, two times. I mean, I'll use the UVA football game analogy from the other night. The first time Virginia failed to recover an onside kick. Okay. Good for Georgia Tech. They recovered the onside kick. Second time, what's my special teams coach doing? Not telling these kids the first time, that you need to cover that damn ball. That's what the situation is here with city council. You screwed up the first time you put this animal ordinance out there. Okay, you screwed up. Second time is a pattern. And I think some folks on that city council need to remind the city manager and his staff who works for who.
All right, Chris, so that's all the news topics we had to discuss today. Anything else that you're working on this week? I know, of course, UVA is on a roll and you've got a lot of sports podcasts that are coming up this week dealing with that, but anything that people should be looking for throughout the week?
Virginia plays BYU, which is a homecoming game of sorts for Bronco Mendenhall and 14 of his assistant coaches who came with him from BYU back in 2015. Got a story on the site already about just how personal this game will be, and not in a bitter way, certainly at all. It's going to be a tough homecoming for all those folks going back out to BYU. And not to mention, it's a pretty important game for both of these teams. They're both 6-2. BYU's 25th in the country. Virginia's trying to make its way maybe to an Orange Bowl berth later in the season. So big football game. We've got a lot of coverage there. Also this week on the Jerry Ratcliffe Show podcast, we're going to have Thomas Jones, former UVA great, now an actor out in Hollywood. I'm going to talk with him on Thursday. I haven't gotten a time for that, but looking at Thursday to talk with Thomas Jones. He was a guy, I want to say he was either fourth or fifth in the Heisman voting in 1999. He also had a really big game on the road at BYU back in, I think, 90. He was either 98 or 99, had over 200 yards in rushing in a game against the Cougars out that way. So we're going to talk with him about, you know, that memory from BYU games past, also about his career, his long NFL career, over 11,000 yards rushing in the NFL, and then his acting career. And so besides that, we have an election to get ready for, and that's coming up next Tuesday. So a lot of election coverage. Yeah, busy week for us here on AFP.
All right. Well, definitely, if you want to read more about the stories we talked about on today's podcast, go to AugustaFreePress.com, or you can find links to the stories on our Facebook page. Just search Augusta Free Press. For Augusta Free Press, I'm Crystal Graham, joined as always by editor Chris Graham. We hope you'll join us back next Tuesday for our next podcast. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Street Knowledge with Chris Graham. Get up-to-the-minute local news, politics, and sports online at AugustaFreePress.com.